This episode of The Edge is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek.fm at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
You're listening to Trek FM.
What have you done out there on the edge of Federation space?
Welcome, listeners, to Postcards from the Edge. I am your host, Amy Nelson, and with me this week is the one and only Chris Jones, founder of Trek FM. Chris, welcome to Postcards.
Thanks, Amy. It's good to be on here with you. I'm sure listeners are going, wait, Chris still has a voice? He never podcasts anymore. But I hope to change that sometime soon. I am on Melodic Treks 100, though, this week with Abishay.
Yes, I heard that. That is a wonderful, wonderful episode. I enjoyed your five picks plus an honorable mention that you snuck in there.
Had to. That was so difficult, picking five tracks from all of Star Trek.
Yeah. Well, I was just very honored that you messaged and said that you wanted to be on Postcards and thought, you know, get you on the last Postcards for season two with a season two wrap up. So again, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to be on here.
Of course. I would love to actually be on the main show sometimes if I didn't live in Tokyo and I didn't spend so much time on a train or in an office. So I'm glad I have this chance for sure.
Excellent. Well, we are going to discuss the fan response to season two as a whole, to wrap up the entire season. And I did have a chance to run the numbers on the past 14 weeks. And I have some amazing statistics. It was so much fun. I just math geeked out completely. Now, if you're interested, please go and check the thread on the Babel Conference, and I'm going to post all my charts and graphs. I've got a scatter plot with a line of regression, a bar graph, a histogram, and a box and whisker plot. Now, that linear regression, I know, I went crazy.
It's math from the edge.
That's right. So the linear regression did have a slope of a positive 18 with initial value of 180. So for you math illiterates, that is the slope has the meaning of an increase of 18 comments on average every week. And again, with initial value of 180. So I found it very interesting. Thank you, listeners, for indulging in my math geekiness. It was a very fun project, and I just might use these numbers next year with my students. So we've got a lesson plan already in the works for me, so thank you. So let's get to the discussion. Now, Chris, I'm sure that you've had time to watch all of season two. What did you think of the season overall?
Oh, what a question, Amy. What a question. This is a difficult question for me. I have watched season two. I've watched most of the episodes, I think, six times now, maybe seven times. The finale, I haven't been able to watch that many times yet. I'm preparing notes from the edge, so I'm going through and I'm watching all the episodes over and over. Originally, sort of in random order, and right now I'm going back through again. And my thoughts are very complicated, and I would say it depends on whether we are talking about the cast or the acting or the art style, design, visual effects, or the story concept or the writing or the execution of the concept. It depends on which one of those things we're talking about. I either loved season two or I have some serious issues with season two. But overall, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a fun ride. the writing is the area where I just have some issues. And it's hard to talk about that really because, you know, these days on Twitter, you tend to get attacked if you don't love everything about Discovery. And if you share critical analysis of the writing, then you're branded a hater and people don't want to hear from you and such. That's not true across the board, but it happens enough that I think it dampens the desire among some fans to kind of honestly talk about what we were watching. I'll get into that stuff when I do Notes from the Edge. For me, like, the highlight of the season, I felt, was the cast. The cast of the show is just fantastic. I think that they are the best ensemble cast that the franchise has ever put together, apart from Deep Space Nine, because the Deep Space Nine cast, for me, is the best cast ever in Star Trek on an actor-by-actor basis. And there are so many actors, and they were all so good. But I see that in this show as well. And I think this season highlighted it, and people they brought on. Of course, Anson Mount, you know, I love him. I talk about it on Twitter all the time. But the actors, they all bring 100% every time, whatever material they're given. They deliver it so well, and I really love watching them. So in that respect, I thought the season was fantastic. The design of the show is great. The visuals are great. The attention to detail, the fact that they know that for the first time ever, this is a Star Trek series that's being watched in high definition on giant televisions, and you can read everything on the screen and everything on the exterior of the ship, the textures on the hulls, the lighting on the set, and it's all beautifully done. And then there's the story. I thought the season started off, it was very promising. It was a very strong start. Brother was great. New Eden was really great. I love that episode. The concept of the Red Angel I thought was really fascinating. But then as the season went on, I felt like it started to not make sense. And the story, if you watch it over and over and you start digging into the details like I'm doing for notes, you really start to notice how there are so many inconsistencies, internal inconsistencies in this story, and things that don't make sense and dots that don't connect. And I felt like the writers started to forget the rules that they had established for themselves, and then they would get into a corner, and then they would look for some magical solution to move the plot along. And that started to take me out of it a little bit. But overall, if you take the overall story and the overall concept, it was interesting, and I think it was a fun ride. And so that's all I'll share today. People have been asking me for a long time, what did you think about it? What did you think about it? So I thought I would share a little bit. But Larry and I are preparing to record a Ready Room episode where we do a full look back at season two. So I'll share more then, and then Notes from the Edge, I'll be doing one for every episode. And I'm also going to do them for the shorts. So in the end, we'll end up with, I think, 19, 20 episodes. I'm thinking of doing like an initial one that's just sort of a warm up before I get into everything, because my approach is going to be a little bit different this time, doing it after the fact. Yeah. So there's my long spiel about what I thought about the season.
Excellent. Well, let's get to what the fans thought of this. And Chris, why don't you start us off?
All right, Amy. So yeah, let's jump into fan response. And our first bit of response is from Jim Stoffel. And Jim said, "So my overall reaction is I loved it. Burnham is still my favorite character on Discovery. She is the emotional center of the show. I wished there was more Tilly in the second half of the season. She seemed more in the background. Her enthusiasm and honesty is why I connect with her so much. I loved the Spock-Michael relationship. Detmer needs an episode about her character. She kicks butt. I want more Stamets and Culber. The only issue I had was there were too many characters at times that not everyone got a fair share of screen time. Pike was the surprise of the season. My wife and I loved him, and I can't wait for season 3. The future of Discovery looks great.
Yes, thank you, Jim. I absolutely agree. Pike was quite the surprise. Absolutely loved
he
him
was.
As well.
Yeah.
Yes. So Dan McWilliams writes, "They left me wanting more in the end, and I believe that's a good thing with any show. Some shows leave you wanting less. That said, I was fully entertained and into the story, not only as a fan, but as someone who wants to see Star Trek appear to others who might not have watched all 3,000 episodes and movies before."
I think you may have overcalculated there a little bit. I mean, you're the math expert, Amy, but I'm just saying, if there are 3,000 episodes, I have missed some.
Right, yes. He continues and says, "I think this season was something special and alone, with an intriguing, timey-wimey story of almost Doctor Who style. Along those lines, I disagree with the real-world decision to have Starfleet erase Discovery from history. I don't see any real point to trying to make every little thing align with canon when it comes to a show that is now over 50 years old. In my mind, most people don't care that Spock never spoke of this adopted sister of his, nor do most people care that Discovery's adventures never made it in dialogue during, say, the voyage home. I think we could have had 23rd century episodes just fine and continued the story in a larger universe without messing up Kirk and Spock's adventures, and that's an opinion I'm sticking to. That said, I'm looking forward to seeing where this goes in season 3.
Very good. Thank you, Dan, for sharing that. And Joshua DeVries wrote in and said, "I think Disco has made some amazing choices in terms of shifting the tone in a more positive direction, especially since it echoes Michael Burnham's return to grace. I also love the extra depth they added to Spock and Pike. I think the show is still finding a good balance of plot and character, but it's going in a good direction. I do hope that future episodes give us more simpler off-duty moments, so it's not just perpetual trauma and grief. I think New Eden was a great example of a quieter, self-contained oasis amid a larger, more intense arc, and I hope we get more episodes like that in the next season." I absolutely agree, Joshua. Needing more episodes like New Eden, perfect example of how you can have those types of stories in the midst of a longer arc, and having more off-duty character moments. That's something I've thought about many times as I'm watching.
Yeah, the perpetual trauma and grief, like you said, Josh, is so intense. And it's like, okay, just give me a breather. Let me enjoy what I'm seeing here. So great points, Josh.
It often feels like we're being told how to feel. Like yes. It's being forced upon us.
Yes.
That's how I feel as well.
Zainab Amadahi says, "I think I maxed out on Burnham-centered stories. Her redemption, her family dramas, her love life, etc. I like the character, but less and less. Maybe it's a question of overexposure. My other nitpick is all the drawn-out emo scenes that dragged on far too long after the point was made. Nevertheless, I love Disco and will continue to watch. The highlights for me in season 2, Jet Reno's unique mix of wisdom and sarcasm in every scene she appeared in, Burnham confessing to Amanda she'd done something terrible to Spock, Tilly's what just happened after Georgiou flirts with Stamets and Culber, Tyler vowing to support Laurel after finding out about their kid, then later kissing his son goodbye, and even later getting the torchbearer totem back via Pike. Every single fight with Georgiou, and finally, Burnham's slow reconciliation with Spock. Topping the list, Pike's decision to take the time crystal, thus sealing his fate. That last one made the season for me. Congrats to the writers, directors, and all the creatives involved for an exciting season full of new concepts and new takes on old ones. That must be hard to do with the weight of so much canon." Well, thank you, Zainab. Those are some great highlights of the season.
Yeah, Star Trek has a very heavy canon.
And the fans will never let you forget it.
All right. So next we have, and I'm sorry if I mispronounce your name, Josh, but it's Josh Truax, who wrote in, with a very short observation, saying Season 2 managed to both dive deep into the series' TOS-era connections and then unshackle the series from those connections. Now, all bets are off for what's in store for Season 3. Hashtag Disco Unchained.
I love that.
So this is an interesting point for me because I have thought about this one myself, especially after hearing Kurtzman talk about how by jumping to the future, now we're free of the shackles of canon. My only comment about that is that they put themselves in that box in the first place and they didn't have to. So Season 3 is a major course correction. It's an admission that maybe we shouldn't have put ourselves in this box in the first place.
Right. Chris Hill says, my overall thoughts on Season 2 are that I continue to be blown away in the best of ways by how much quote/unquote Star Trek we see with each new episode. From the connections we see on screen, the Otto Antonym scene, for example, to the self-sacrifices of Pike and Cornwell, to the technobabble. I think this season is the strongest one yet. I have seen elsewhere that some folks are saying that the interactions of the crew are forced. To that, I say these little connection moments like we've seen in past series of Star Trek have happened off screen. My overall rating for Season 2 is 6.5 out of 7 red things. Oh, that's funny. I felt that between the acting, the battles, the character arcs, and seeing Pike in action made this season better than the first. Well, Chris, did you think this is better than the season one?
That's a difficult question, too. You know, I said earlier that the season started off with a lot of promise, and I think it's because Brother and New Eden and Pike's presence on the ship and his command style felt like a return to the Star Trek that we're more familiar with, whereas season one was so much darker and, you know, Lorca was not the kind of captain that we would expect. But then I think it went in a different direction because they didn't pick up on the things they set up in New Eden and so forth. I would say overall as a season, yeah, season two is stronger than season one. But the first half of season one was not more interesting than season two, but it was more interesting than the second half of season one. When they jumped to the Mirror Universe, it felt like, we don't really know what to do, so hey, let's go play in the Mirror Universe.
Yeah, it seems like they start the seasons really strong, and I feel the same way with season two. Like, the first part of the season, I was loving, and then sort of at the end, I was like, what's going on here? So, interesting that they start well and are having a difficult time finishing and wrapping things up.
If I can throw in one more observation as we go through these related to that, I think, well, first the Spock chase got kind of old, so I'm glad they finally caught up with him. But I think revealing the Red Angel so early on, there were still so many episodes after that, I think that was a mistake because that's where it all fizzled for me. Like this concept of like, what is the Red Angel? That was interesting. But then after that, the things that happened, it just seemed like, yeah, maybe they kind of lost the momentum a bit.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, our next bit of input is from Janessa Chiarda. And Janessa says, like season one, the characters are compelling enough to make me overlook weaknesses in the script. Unlike season one, I've probably watched every episode, except the last one, more than 5 times, which reflects my overall enjoyment level this season. Looking forward to the tie-in novels and comics for the story between the story to keep my appetite up until season three. Yeah, I'm with Janessa there, too. I keep rewatching the episodes, so even though I'm critical sometimes as I'm watching, I obviously enjoy it because I keep watching it. And as I said about the actors at the beginning, I just enjoy watching this cast, so I find new things every time I watch.
Right, yeah. And yeah, they're going to be having, we get another novel coming out, right?
I believe so, yep.
Yeah, and then, yeah, the comics and then the short treks. I'm curious to know what these short treks are going to be. Are they going to be Discovery? Are they going to, I don't know. Are they going to sort of launch Picard series? I don't know.
I believe it has been said that at least one of the short treks will be animated. So that may tie in to Lower Decks or to the Nickelodeon show. But it's a good point. They don't have to be Discovery. Last time, they were all related to Discovery in some way. But the concept of short treks is not tied to this series.
All right. So Sanjeev Gopal says, I liked how the season started with the standalone episodes moving the bigger plot along. The mystery of the Red Angel had a great faith/science feel to it. And I think they dropped the ball when they did not explore the faith side of the equation more fully, especially since we learned early on that Pike was a man of faith. Even though Pike was great and Anson Mount was the perfect casting for him, I wanted to learn more about him. I am over Burnham being the center of the show and Tilly being comic relief. There is so much potential for Tilly to be a great member of the crew. In a nutshell, the visuals and production value of the show is off the chart. It's a game changer on what studios can do on a small screen. The story was okay and some of the characters were great. The highlight of the season for me was Pike and the 1701. I'm looking forward to basically a whole new trek in season 3. Well, Sanjeev, you just absolutely said exactly what I'm thinking. Definitely wanted to learn more about Pike, and you're right. Exactly. We found out that he was a man of faith, and then it just was dropped.
So much was dropped from New Eden. The whole, the stained glass and how all the religions were come together. It's like they wanted to set up the idea of the Red Angel being tied to religions and faith, but that didn't go anywhere after that. You know, there's a comment later about, there were a few comments about how the term angel carries with it certain connections to religions, but it doesn't really go much further than that. I agree with Sanjeev here about Burnham being the center of the story. I understand the concept of that, but I think that it holds this show back. There's too much focus on her, and that's why we don't know anything about the other characters. It's not because there are only 14 episodes, because these episodes are longer. Most of these episodes are 52, 53 minutes. Some of them are a bit shorter, and some of them are a bit longer. But in a past series like Deep Space Nine, you've got 26 episodes. It was serialized. They developed 20-something characters. And even characters who only had 7-8 episodes total on the show, you felt like you knew them so well. So you could still develop all these bridge crew characters, Jet Reno, all these people you're bringing on, they could be developed. But Burnham is the center of the story, which is why we kind of always knew that she was the Red Angel, because that's the story. It's Burnham's story, right? They're not going to deviate from that. And I agree with Sanjeev as well about Tilly. Great potential for a character. Mary Wiseman is a great actress. She does a wonderful job. But there were just cringeworthy moments in this season in the writing where she comes in and says something that's supposed to be funny, but it's just, even the bridge crew is looking at her like, huh? You know, there are those moments, and I do wish that they would let her do more. They do sometimes let her do more, but I wish that they would just move away from that. Humor in Star Trek is best when it's very organic and it just comes out. That's why DS9 is the funniest Star Trek series, because it has so many of those types of moments in it. It's why Star Trek 4 is so good. There was no, that humor's not forced. That humor naturally came from the situation they found themselves in.
And I have to agree with you on the visuals and production value. Like every single episode, I just seriously, I'm watching it and seeing it, yeah, and listening to it, you know, with the music that
Jeff Russo.
Yes, Jeff Russo did. It's just so stimulating to the senses to just see it and hear it. It really is amazing. And I love how we are getting TV Star Trek this amazing.
Yeah, it's like you're at the movies. I actually want to buy a bigger television just to watch Star Trek Discovery on, because I usually watch on my iPad, which is a 12.9, so the screen's decent. In my rewatches, I'm watching on my 27-inch 4K displays on my computer. But what I really want is like a 65-inch TV so I can really watch the visuals. And speaking to the sound design and the music, I watch with my big Bose Quiet Comfort cans on so I can like really hear all that detail because it's so well done.
Yeah.
It's so immersive.
Did you just love the end of Such Sweet Sorrow, the end credits? That was amazing how they intertwined the original series and the Discovery theme together. Oh, that was my favorite.
Yeah, the score for this show has been fantastic. Okay, so let's go on to the next one. Eric Brady wrote in, and Eric said, I think season two was awesome despite some plot holes. The redesigned Enterprise and uniforms were awesome. I loved seeing Spock again as well. The season finale was great until the end when Discovery went 930 years in the future to avoid Trek canon. It's like a slap in the face to Trek fans. Well, Eric, you know, you left out something really important here. I want to know if you think the beard is working. I know you love seeing Spock, but you didn't mention the facial hair.
That's been a huge debate.
But, you know, my take on the jump to avoid Trek canon, that is the reason that they're jumping, because in terms of the story, they didn't need to jump at the end.
Exactly.
There was no need. So they're definitely jumping to the future to escape canon. To say it's a slap in the face to Trek fans, I'm not that harsh with it. I am a creative professional. I have been my whole career. I think like a writer. I think like I create things. And so if that's what they want to do with the story, fine. You know, I can understand the thought process. I think it's a bit harsh for us to assume that they are there only to serve what we think they should do. But I understand Eric's feelings as well.
Yeah. So what did you think of the redesigned Enterprise?
I thought it was, well, the exterior I thought looked fantastic. And I know some people complained a bit about some of the changes, but you have to change something. You know, when they did TOS remastered, they stayed pretty true to that original design. But I think that just doesn't hold up on people watching on giant 4K televisions. And also, it wouldn't have fit with the art style of the rest of the show. You know, the Enterprise has to feel like it's part of that world that we're seeing, that Discovery is part of. So I didn't have a problem with that at all. The interior for me, it was a little bit odd. You know, Spock's quarters with the red, the way the corridors were done. I started to say it takes some, you know, suspension of disbelief, but it's not exactly that. You just have to go with it. You have to say, well, okay, this is what the Enterprise looks like on the inside. And what we saw before, yeah, it was different, but this is what it really was. Like, I'm okay with that and going that way. The bridge, obviously the bridge had to be updated and they had to do all the displays the way that they did. Otherwise, it just wouldn't have felt right on this show. I think they did a beautiful job with the design. It's a little bit different. The uniforms looked great. You know, they took a little creative liberty with those uniforms, but that's fine. They needed to, you know, there were some details that fit in with the Discovery uniforms so they could show that progression, because there's that line early on, like, we got the new uniforms. So you can imagine, if you're in universe, that at the Starfleet Academy of Fashion, when they're designing those, they're going to take cues from what they've already designed and move it forward. That made sense, and I think that's the way they should have done it.
All right, we have Mark Keller, and he writes, I think Discovery Season 2 will go down as one of the greatest in Trek history. The whole season was great, but I think it peaked when Michael and Spock visited Talos IV. My favorite part of the season was the online discussion about the mystery of the Red Angel and the signals. Great times. Yeah, well, through the whole season, we have had some amazing discussions on the Babel Conference, and it has definitely changed the way that I have experienced Star Trek. It's been so unique and interesting, to say the least.
Yeah, the discussions were fun. I kind of stay out of the discussions, and I don't read too many of them because I don't want to be influenced too much before I do Notes from the Edge, because I want to really share what I think about what I'm watching. I did see some, though, and this season they did a better job with the plot twists of keeping us guessing, even though we knew it's going to end up being Michael. They threw in some other things, which I'm going to follow as I do notes. I'm going to share in the order I watched the episodes what I thought might be going on, because I had a couple of fun theories along the way. So I think they did a good job in that sense this time. And Talos 4, I just watched that episode yesterday, and I really enjoyed that episode a lot. All right, Mark Bagnall wrote in and said, "The season has been absolutely phenomenal. The visual effects are movie quality in each episode, but the action doesn't detract from the character moments or moral dilemmas we love in Star Trek. I still have a few questions, most likely from things I've missed, but I'm sure they will be answered when I do a rewatch. Can't wait to see season 3 already. I just want to see Michael have some happy scenes. She's had a lot of sad and emotional scenes throughout. It would be great to see her laughing and enjoying herself." So what do you think about that, Amy? Do you agree that the action doesn't detract from the character moments and that all the questions will be answered on a rewatch?
Well, I don't know about all the questions. No, I thought the action scenes were good. I mean, Michelle Yeoh is fabulous, and she's always good. There were some really good scenes, Saru, and yeah, they've been great. But I did want to talk about seeing Michael enjoy herself and laughing. And I was thinking, gosh, when did we see her laugh? And I can only think, and correct me if I'm wrong, way back in season 1, Battle of the Binary, where she got in the suit to go explore this sarcophagus ship. And she was laughing and, you know, and I was like, yeah, she's smiling and she's enjoying herself and she's exploring. And I can't remember a time where she laughed this season.
Yeah. The season was very emotionally intense for her.
Yeah.
And that's fine. It's interesting to follow as a story. It gets a bit heavy at times, which I think is probably the main point here.
All right. Ken Tripp writes, "For those that really love the show and this season, I'm very happy for you, and it makes me reflect back to the joy I had in escaping into TOS, the movies, TNG, and so on. For those that are not finding it to be what they had hoped, I understand as well. I could list a lot of things that are both really good and a lot of opportunities for improvement. But the point is that enough people are watching and enjoying it to keep Star Trek alive and growing. CBS All Access has my $99 a year and can't wait for the new series spinoffs and season 3. I would never give up on any Star Trek series and won't give up on Disco." Well, Ken and I have had some interesting discussions when he was here visiting. It's very interesting to still hear people say that they're not going to pay for CBS, or that I've seen some comments where they watched season 1 and then they watched like the first episode and then just stopped and quit watching and, you know, turned off their subscription. I was like, oh my goodness, I wouldn't do that.
Yeah, the whole uproar about CBS All Access, in light of all the new services that are coming now, maybe it'll change perceptions a little bit. This is what we were all clamoring for a decade ago. We don't want cable. We want a la carte everything. Well, we got our wish, and it turns out that it costs as much or more than cable if you want to have all the different services. And we'll see what's going to get pulled from Netflix and Hulu and put onto other proprietary streaming services coming up, which are going to cost us another $10 a month if we want to watch shows. But I'm happy to pay. Now, of course, in Japan, I get Discovery on Netflix, but I don't mind paying for a service like CBS All Access. I just wish the CBS All Access app worked better and that it felt like it was designed and programmed by someone who actually knew how to make an app, because it's pretty bad.
It's a mess. Oh my gosh. And, you know, I don't mind paying for CBS because I watch a lot of the other shows. And it was because of CBS All Access that I ended up cutting cable, because most of the other shows I watch are already on CBS. So I'm like, oh, well, I can still have my shows. But my goodness, that app and how it's designed is just terrible. It's just annoying me. They need to pick up some cues from Netflix, because I like how Netflix has it. Amazon Prime is okay, but yeah, CBS is the worst out of them all, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah. So that could be improved, but we'll see where it goes. All right. So Stuart Davies wrote in, and Stuart said, "It's going to need a second watch for me. At the moment, I've not enjoyed it as much as season one. It's had a few moments that pulled me out of episodes as well, especially The Red Angel, which had more than a few clunkers story-wise that just had me shaking my head. And whilst I've not enjoyed the story as much, the character work has been excellent this season. Stamets and Culber, Saru, Pike, and it goes on. I really enjoyed getting to know the crew this year, something I feel was missing from season one." Well, I would say I've enjoyed getting to know some of the crew this year, a little bit. Again, that's a case where, you know, the story, it started out very promising. When Pike said, "Give me a roll call, I want to know who I'm working with," I thought, this is good. They're going to get everyone to speak. They're going to know their names, and that's what I want to see more of. Stamets and Culber as well. This is a part of the story that's been a little bit frustrating to me, because I think Anthony Rapp and Wilson Cruz have played this really well. It feels like a real relationship, and you can feel from both of them what the storyline has done to them emotionally. But they're not getting enough time with that story. It feels so much like an afterthought to what's going on with the Red Angel and the other elements of the story. And I wish that they would give that more time. And hopefully they will in season three. But we'll never be able to go back to season two and get the additional on-screen moments between them that I think they deserved and that we needed as a viewer. So that's sort of disappointing to me that we're not going to get that. But that is a prime example of where I think they wrote a very real story, a very real relationship, and you've got two actors who are bringing it to life in a way that really connects. And I think it connects with people no matter what your sexual orientation is. You know, I'm straight, but that relationship and the emotional trials that they're going through still connect with me very much. And I often actually tweet at both of them as I'm watching, you know, just to say thank you for these moments, because I think it's been great.
Yeah, the portrayal and that relationship, I mean, I've just heard so many good things about it and how real it is and how it feels and how it comes across on screen, and the chemistry that they have together is truly amazing. Yeah, the actors are really what's making this relationship work so well.
Yeah, definitely. Great.
Well, David Shuford writes, "A definite improvement over season one. I binge watched the first three episodes, and about halfway through, I had to go upstairs and tell my wife, 'Finally, Discovery is feeling like Star Trek.' I enjoyed this season and am willing to overlook numerous story issues and inconsistencies. Although sometimes annoying, in a final analysis, these faults did not prevent me from thoroughly liking Discovery. Captain Pike was amazing and Jet Reno was a real hoot. I'm an engineer and all I can say is that I'm with you, sister. Duct tape, aka Hanford bailing wire, will fix about anything. It will be interesting to see how season three goes. But for the moment, I'll be happy to rewatch season two.
I love Jet Reno, and I was disappointed that we didn't get more of her. She's like a real person.
Yes.
Right? She's the person, if you were really there in real life in the 23rd century, an engineer in Starfleet, she just comes off like a real person. And I love the duct tape bit. I love the fact that in the future with all this high tech, she can still fix stuff with duct tape. I don't know how many people will get the reference, but I said early on when she first came on that she's the Joe of Discovery, referring to Joe Rogan's character on News Radio, which is one of my favorite sitcoms, because Joe would fix everything in the studio with duct tape.
Ah, you know, Jet Reno took some warming up for me because when she came on, she was so just harsh. And I was like, what is this character? And why is she always cracking jokes? This is not a joke. And, but I definitely have warmed up to her, especially, with her interactions with Stamets. I just think it's good.
it was great. Oh, I loved her from the moment she came on screen. It's like, I built them. You're welcome. Just so straightforward. And thought, yeah, this is a real person. I hope that she's going to be on the show in season three and we get to see more of her.
Well, she's on Discovery that went to the future. So,
but that doesn't mean that she'll get any screen time.
Well, that's true. When I was at the Paley Fest in LA, she was there and she was surprised that they keep asking her back. And she's like, you know, I'm not really an actor. And so she has.
But that's why it works.
Exactly. Right. And she's like, yeah, they keep asking me. And so I keep saying yes. And I'm like, all right. I really think we're going to see her for sure.
I hope so. Hope so. All right. Our next bit of input is from Rhea Papagiorgio, and I hope I didn't mispronounce that. Rhea says, we all acknowledge there were some glaring plot holes, but the actors were so phenomenal, in all capital letters, that Disco Season 2 was a true treasure. Pike was probably the standout character, and we got to see the development to various degrees of other characters as well. Like so many have already said, they left us wanting more. I still want to see an Arium short trek. The show took a risk from the beginning by centering on a non-captain, and most of us groaned at times when Burnham as Messiah seemed forced. I'm hoping that the writers can center the show on Burnham more naturally in subsequent seasons, with less forced, gut-wrenching emotion. The writers pushed canon and technology. I love canon more than the average bear, but would rather see the writers stick to their guns and not back down so readily, such as the family Sarek declaring they would never speak of Michael again. I really didn't think they needed to go that far. But overall, I thought this season was so much fun. Every week I was glued to the TV, and most weeks had to rewatch the episode right away. Time will tell if the season stands the test of time, but I don't doubt that it will stand up to the haters. How do you feel about that, Amy? There are a few points in here I'm curious about.
There are. Rhea, you definitely say a lot. So thank you for your comment. And you bring up the point that we know that we were getting this non-captain focus. And so it was Burnham. And I think you're right. I'm hoping that it can be a little bit more natural. So I really do agree with you on that point. And of course, Pike was the standout character this season, obviously, in mine. I'm not sure that I want an Arium short trek. We had that season with her and I'm completely...
I think we got an Arium short trek It's called the first half of Project Daedalus.
Yes, right. So, yeah. What do you think of Rhea's comment there? What do you want to touch on?
I think it's pretty spot on. You know, the Burnham stuff, it is forced a lot. And Sonequa Martin-Green, she plays that really well. She's very good with her line delivery, with her facial expressions of drawing out that emotion. But it just gets to be a bit much sometimes. And there are moments where I feel like her acting is a bit forced. But then when I feel that way, I stop and think, is it true? And then I think, well, maybe not. It's just, that's her style. The Arium thing, I'm quite on record about being upset about the whole way Arium was handled. And as far as canon goes, like not backing down so readily, yeah, I would kind of agree with that. I think that this season, they were too concerned with trying to sync up with canon to the point where it didn't make sense anymore. One example is in the beginning, in Point of Light, so what, third episode of the season? We've got Ash and Laurel presenting the blueprints for, here's the D7, it's the future battle cruiser of the Imperial fleet. And then 8 episodes later, Laurel shows up in her flagship, which is a D7. How long does it take to build a starship? And not only that, but then the fleet arrives and they're D7s. So you built a bunch of other ones, but she said DD7, singular. There's only one. These kinds of things don't match up. And the whole today is a good day to die. It was too much of like syncing up with canon to the point where we're going to jump 930 years into the future. We're not going to see this 23rd century anymore. So let's make sure we tick off all the boxes before we make the jump. Even though in terms of the real passage of time, it doesn't make any sense. And I can overlook all that. It doesn't necessarily take me out of the story because I'm looking more at the narrative. Like what's the story? You know, the term headcanon, I don't know where it really originated, but we started saying headcanon on the Ready Room 9 years ago. And at that time, I didn't hear that around very much. And in Ready Room discussions, we would start explaining things and we would say, well, in my headcanon, this is what happened. And now that's a big thing that everyone talks about. But I like it because I think if you're going to enjoy Star Trek, something that's as rich as Star Trek, you have to have headcanon. You have to figure out what works for you. And it can't always be a black and white literal, this happened in episode 47 of The Next Generation, and therefore it can never be violated again, right? You have to give writers flexibility.
Yeah.
In that sense.
Yeah. Definitely. Well, here in Postcards, we don't always read the positive. We do get to some questions and complaints. We have just a few this week. So let's start with Jason Chapman. And he says, in one of the season 2 episodes, Captain Georgiou was eating an apple on the Discovery while talking to Michael in the hallway. Then Georgiou drops the apple on the floor. My biggest question, is that half-eaten apple still on the floor in the hallway? Did that go to the future too? Will the rest of the apple have anything to do with season 3? Well, Jason, your comedy is quite funny there.
Comedy? No, Amy, I'm amazed at the synergy. I mean, I think Jason and I, we're like Vulcans. We have like this telepathic connection across space and time because this is the most burning question for me. What happened to that apple?
Oh my goodness.
I think the apple is probably not still on the floor because I think one of those little repair robots probably zoomed down the corridor and swept it up. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that the apple will not be central to the plot of season 3.
It just may.
I mean, 930 years of evolution of an apple. Who knows what we might see?
Well, when we see a big apple tree in the middle of the hallway, then we'll know.
No, in Saru's quarters, because he has so many plants
exactly,
in there already.
Right?
Right. Oh. Yeah. He'll say, I brought the seeds of this with me from the past.
There you go. But we can't talk about it because, you know, it's canon.
We shall never
speak
of that apple again. Amy, never. That apple never existed. Okay, N. Bartholomew wrote in, and N. said, I thought it was good. Reducing Tilly to comic relief was disappointing, though. And I think we kind of covered that in some of our thoughts about some of the input in the positive section, which we mixed with a lot of our own concerns or questions, I suppose. But I do agree. Yeah, she was reduced to comic relief many times.
You know, and it's a little sad to still hear this because it was brought up a lot in season one when we were doing, you know, the Edge and postcards and, you know, especially at the end, and they just, that's all Tilly was. And, you know, she did have, again, the start of the season, she was good. She was working with Stamets and engineering and problem solving. And then we get this, well, I can do that, but the last time I did it, I was drunk. And I was like, really? Do we need that? Yeah.
There was one moment, I think it's when she comes in to reveal that Michael is the Red Angel. It might be a different scene, because it actually happened pretty much every entrance. As the season went on, every time she came in, it had to start with her saying some kind of crazy, silly thing. She can't just come in and deliver information or act like one of the regular crew members, which was disappointing because I think at this point, a season and a half in, almost two seasons in, and now she's an ensign and she's been in this command training program, I think that she would, in real life, be behaving a bit calmer. She wouldn't be jumping to that. Now, some people may disagree with me. I'm sure that they do, because I know many people identify with her and her personality. And that's great. If that connects with people, then the writers are doing their job there. But for me, it takes me out of the story sometimes, because I just feel like, do we have to have this moment again? Like, every time, do we have to do this? So, I don't know. I feel like by the end of season two, it's worse than it was in season one, because many people really like that comic relief from her. But I think there's a line that you can cross where it stops being funny comic relief and it starts being annoying. But if people say they like it, then the writers think, oh, this is popular. People like it when Tilly's like this. So let's make sure we keep putting that in. That's the difference between Star Trek 4 and Star Trek 5. Star Trek 4 was a huge success with the humor, so let's make Star Trek 5 funny also. But the jokes in Star Trek 5 don't work the way that they did in 4.
Brian McVicker writes, unfortunately, after watching two seasons of Discovery, it just seems I won't be able to connect to this show. I've been a fervent fan of Star Trek since 1987, primarily due to TNG, and have loved pretty much every iteration of Trek since then, including the Kelvin era movies. But with Discovery, it just isn't working. I find every character either irritating or a complete a-hole. Thank you for not swearing, Brian.
In text.
I'm weary of Burnham being the center of everything, and still am upset at how the writer shoehorned her in as Spock's foster sister. Spock's character didn't need a secret foster sister to help him to become who he is in any way. The show isn't really about anything either. There's more exploration of the human condition, social and civil rights issue on the Orville than on Discovery, and it's supposed to be Trek's bread and butter. All Discovery can do is simply put everyone at war in season one, lean heavily on nostalgia elements with the Mirror Universe, Section 31, and the Enterprise, and then this season have a convoluted time travel plot, which I still can't make sense of. There's no joy in watching the show, just consistent annoyance. Also, they never stop moving the camera. I mean, just lock it down during a conversation scene at least once. Well, Brian, you definitely must have been listening to me and know that I get so annoyed with the spinning of the camera. So I completely agree with you there. And I also love the Orville and love the, you know, the civil rights and the social and the human condition that the Orville gets to, you know, have on their show. So, Chris, what do you think about Brian's comment there?
Well, I think it's pretty harsh, but I don't disagree with parts of it. I wouldn't say that I find every character irritating or a complete a-hole. I don't get that at all. The only character I find irritating is Tilly at times, but I think that she has a lot of potential. So there are moments where I like her just fine, and there are moments where I find her irritating. But I don't know. We don't know enough about most of the characters to make that kind of judgment, in my opinion. The characters that we do know a lot about, Pike, I loved him. Michael, I think she's overly dramatic, but she's been through a lot in her life. Stamets kind of comes and goes for me. I like him a lot better now than I did in the early episodes of season one, where he came off as very arrogant. You know, he's kind of calmed down.
Now, I know you like Saru in season one.
I love Saru.
Okay.
I love Saru in season one and season two. I think Saru is a brilliant character. Doug Jones is a brilliant actor. The way he portrays this character is amazing. Of all the characters on Discovery, Saru is like a timeless Star Trek character who I think could be slotted into any of the series and fit right in. I think he would be amazing on Deep Space Nine because those writers would do so much with him. But Saru is by far of the main cast, the shining gem of Discovery, in my opinion. Yeah, definitely. As far as Brian's comment here about the time travel plot, he still can't make sense of it. It is hard to make sense of. And as I keep digging deeper and deeper into it, preparing notes, it just doesn't make sense. The way the signals appear, who set the signal doesn't make sense. As I watch back through, I'm asking myself, this angel that I'm seeing, is this Burnham's mom or is this Burnham? You don't know part of the time because the things that Burnham's mom supposedly did seem like the things, well, now Burnham herself is saying that she did, but then at the end, she's just got to set the signals. So they go places. It's very convoluted, to say the least. It's very difficult to make sense of. And I don't know if I'm going to get to a point where I can say, okay, Burnham's mom did this, Burnham did this, these are when the signals were set and they appeared, and yeah, it makes sense that I'm going to set a signal so you can find the Hiawatha, so you can find Jet Reno, because then she can duct tape the time crystal, and that way I'm going to be able to go back and set the signal so that you can find the Hiawatha. Huh? It doesn't make sense. But that doesn't mean it's not fun to watch at the same time. You just have to kind of control your level of what you're looking for at the moment. And then it can be fun or it can be annoying.
All right. Well, I'm going to expect you to nail down and do exactly that on your notes.
I'm going to try, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to.
You know, if Burnham made the suit after what she saw Jillian, her mother, did, then how come her suit's making the signals, but Jillian's isn't? Because she...
Well, her mom said, I don't know anything about the signals. So that part's clear. Her mother is not the one setting the signals.
Right.
But...
But then why would Burnham's suit do that if it's patterned after her mother's?
Well, that was her task, was to set the signals. But the one that got me was rewatching The Sound of Thunder when the Red Angel appears and this kind of shockwave comes out and disables all the Ba'ul weapons. Is that Burnham's mother or is that Burnham? If you dig into the story, so far, and I might get there, and maybe someone else has already figured it out, but so far for me, that one does not make any sense. I would assume that it's Burnham's mother, but when Burnham starts checking off why she set the signals, one of them is, set a signal at Kaminar so Discovery will go there to help the Kelpians evolve to prepare them to help out in the battle against Section 31. Why? So, you helped them evolve, and not even 2 weeks later, Saru's sister Serana knows how to fly a spaceship and is playing a lead role in this battle. Remember that a couple of weeks earlier, the Kelpians had no spaceflight capabilities at all. And it is mentioned in the script that the ships are Ba'ul ships. But if the Ba'ul have just been demoted, and the other sentient race, who they have been holding back, who they're scared of, is now going to be the dominant species, why are they helping them? That didn't make any sense. It's just that we want to have Saru's sister come to the rescue. That's the simplicity of the storytelling. And there's this complex setup to make that possible, but the complex setup doesn't make any sense.
Well, and what I was thinking, again, the purpose of that, of them coming on the Ba'ul ships, was to show, okay, so yeah, we disrupted and we helped, you know, the Kelpians evolve, but now everything's okay and they're working together.
Yeah, it just takes a couple of days. Well, I mean, Amy, all you need to look is look around here on Earth, and you can see that when two nations or two ethnic groups, when they distrust each other, they're scared of each other, it only takes a couple of days to get them on the same page, and everything's cool again. So,
yeah. Yeah, and they're helping each other. No resentment. No. Yeah.
So we are being a bit sarcastic here, but this is the kind of thing that if, as a viewer, these types of things in storytelling bother you, then season two of Star Trek Discovery fails in its writing. And I mentioned at the beginning, you can't share critical analysis of this show in social media without being pounced on by a certain group of fans. And people assume that if you point things out like this, you are a Star Trek canon gatekeeper. But what we're talking about here has nothing to do with canon. It has nothing to do with Star Trek. It simply has to do with basic generic storytelling. And whether the story that you're giving the viewer makes logical sense to the viewer. And some people don't care about these connections, and that's fine, and they will love it. And some people do, and then you lose those viewers. That's really all it is here.
Yeah, well, we are very grateful for the Babel Conference and, you know, for Brian feeling comfortable for, you know, stating his opinion, and there wasn't any backlash, and here we are talking about it on Postcards. So,
yeah. And we have one last piece of input to share, and this is from Nicholas Paul Collinson. And Nicholas said, okay, one thing that is still a problem I have with season two, I agree with him on this, I don't know what Control's actual motivation was for wanting to destroy all sentient life. I kind of got the impression that it was the tired old trope of humanity, sentient life, is always having wars and is dangerous to itself and cannot be trusted, therefore must be destroyed for the greater good of the AIs. This is what we've seen with Skynet, with the robots and iRobot. It's so old and tired, and I really wanted something more nuanced than that. I said this to somebody in private messages a couple of weeks ago. I just said, let me ask you one question and tell me if you can give me an answer. What is Control's reason for wanting to destroy all sentient life in the galaxy? Can you tell me? And I was asking the question honestly because I thought maybe I missed something where it's explained in a line of dialogue. But it really isn't. You have to kind of assume, I think what Nicholas is saying, I think that's it. But that's not even stated anywhere. You really do wonder, why? Why must all sentient life in the galaxy be eradicated? And since that's the core of the entire plot, and if the core of the entire plot is never established and never stated, then it's hard for everyone to get on board with why all this drama is happening in the first place.
Yeah, that's very true. And yeah, I don't know that I could answer that question. And again, I'm not familiar with the Skynet reference. What is that from?
That's from Terminator. It's another artificial intelligence-based network.
Yeah. Okay. I haven't seen that. So yeah, I keep missing some of these AI references because I just haven't seen many. So, well, Chris, we have had a lot of comments. How do you think that the fans responded to season two of Discovery?
So the fans who wrote in to Postcards from the Edge or the fans in general?
Well, we'll take Postcard fans. We'll take, yes, the Babel Conference fans. And then you can tell us about out there in Twitter land.
I see. I was just asking. I think the feedback today was really good because in most cases here, in the positive section and in the concerns section, of course, some people just said flat out, I loved it. It was great. And that's wonderful. I'm really happy that people enjoyed it. I think that the majority of these, though, stated, yeah, there are some issues, but I enjoyed it. And that's pretty much how I feel as well. I think that what we need to get back to with Star Trek fandom and the discourse that we have about the show that we're watching is a balanced commentary, an ability to talk about what we liked about a story and what we didn't like. And we should be able to share what a story meant to us and why it connected with us and why it didn't. And within a single story, whether it's an entire season like this or an individual episode, chances are there are going to be elements that connect with us and that we love, and elements that don't connect with us and that we either hate or dislike, or they pull us out of the story, or maybe we're okay with it, but we have ideas for how it could be better. And the reason we think that way, especially having ideas of how it could be better, that stems from our love of the franchise in the first place and our love of the material. If we didn't love it, if we didn't care, we wouldn't bother sharing in the first place. And I think that fandom, I don't want to say fandom in general, because I actually do think that it's a small segment of fandom that has gone down this path of black and white, love it or hate it. If they love it and you don't, then you're bad. Or if they hate it and you like it, you're bad, right? It goes both directions. I think it's a small group, but because of the bullhorn that social media has provided, it seems very loud and it's easy to shout down the other side. And that's not why I created this network. It's not why I started podcasting. I started podcasting so that we could all get together and share ideas. And if people go back and listen to the Ready Room, then they would know that about me. I sometimes have people jump into my timeline on Twitter to tell me how I'm wrong and how I don't respect this group or that group, or I don't want to hear anyone else's opinion. And I know those people have not listened to me over the years, because if you listen to the Ready Room, years ago, before Larry and I started doing it, just the two of us, the past couple of years, which has a lot to do with my schedule, we had panel discussions like the other shows, usually four people. And I'm largely like a moderator, and I don't agree with everything that the other panelists say, but that's not why I'm there. I'm there just to hear what they think. And we always had very respectful discussions, even when we didn't agree. And we often came away from those discussions with a new appreciation for the episode that we were talking about, because someone else shed light on an aspect of the story that we hadn't noticed, or by hearing why they loved something or a character, a plot line, we came around to it. Last point I'll make. When Matthew and I started doing The Orb, I was not a fan of Ezri Dax. But I love Ezri Dax now, and I think Ezri is critical to the conclusion of the Deep Space Nine story. She's absolutely critical to Worf's character arc, and she plays a key role in the conclusion of the Dominion War. I never thought that deeply about her character until Matthew and I started doing The Orb, and we had so many discussions, and Matthew loves Ezri. And listening to Matthew share his thoughts on an aspect of the story that I didn't care much about and thought was maybe not the best idea, it brought me around. And that's the kind of honest, open dialogue that I think we need to have as fans. And I'm glad to see in our feedback here on Postcards that most people had a little bit of a mix in their comments. You know, they recognize that not everything is perfect, but a lot of stuff is great.
I also have hearing these comments and say, well, those things I can just look over because I enjoyed it for this reason. Listeners know I love Nemesis, and that is, anyone can tell me why they hate Nemesis, and I'm like, yep, I hear you, but I'm willing to overlook it, or I see it differently. And so for me, I just love Nemesis, even with its plot holes that people tell me about, and I just, you know. So it's very interesting to hear the fans say that about Discovery. And I think it's so great that we have the opportunity in the Babel Conference to, you know, give our opinions and our thoughts and have these discussions that I think are very open and honest. And with that, listeners, I just wanted to express my gratitude for two wonderful seasons of Discovery. I have absolutely loved reading your comments each and every week as the episodes are released. I feel like we have a real community of Trek family here on the Babel Conference. And I thank each one of you who participate and comment. I mean, it's your participation that allows this podcast to exist. And with that, I need to announce that I will be stepping away from Postcards for season 3.
No, Amy, come on. But the way you're doing it is what I have a problem with. You don't need to jump 930 years into the future, Amy.
Well, that would be, it would actually help me.
But it's fine. I mean, I'm zipping my lips now. We will never speak of you again. Oh, wow. Just kidding.
So I just, you know, although it's been so good for me to read your words and to get to know you, I feel like, you know, I know so many of you, especially by saying your name and your words each and every week. I really have developed a lot of close relationships, and you all know who you are. And thank you for reaching out to me. I just thank all my wonderful positive listeners and my negative Nellies. You know who you are. You definitely have made my Star Trek Discovery so memorable, unique, and special. And I will always remember these two seasons. So I just wanted to make that announcement and thank all of the wonderful listeners.
Well, you're going to be missed on Postcards, Amy, but you're not going away from the network. People can still hear your voice.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Just in case anyone, you know, is taking this as like, I'm disappearing.
No. I'm still going to be on the Edge main show with Patrick. And of course, on Earl Grey, you will not get me away from the Next Gen. So, you can find me here on the network. I'm also on Twitter at Miss Amy Nelson. But as I've mentioned, my favorite place is right there in the Babel Conference. So, Chris, where can people find you?
Well, if you would like to find me podcasting, I don't get to podcast as much these days as I used to. I've had a lot of turmoil in my life the past few years on the health front with my eye. Well, people who listen to the podcasts know about the eye surgery that I went through. And people who follow me on Twitter know a bit about my family situation, my work situation and such. I miss podcasting a lot and I really want to get back to it. And I hope I'm going to be able to. I am going to do Notes from the Edge. I've been asked about that many times. At the beginning of the show, I explained a lot about what I'm going to be doing with that. So I will not repeat that here, but I will start getting those out pretty soon. The way I'm doing it, I'm kind of writing them all at the same time. Some of our listeners, those who are writers, may know about Scrivener. It's an app for long-form writing primarily. I have a Scrivener document project for Notes from the Edge, where I have folders for every episode, characters, plot points, connections into the franchise, and then documents for every character and major plot points and all that. And so as I'm rewatching, I'm sort of writing in all these different documents at the same time, so I can pull everything together into each episode of Notes. And the reason I'm doing that is because I want to follow these threads through and I need to find the connections. Maybe I can find out which angel is doing what. You know, that's one of my goals. So it's taken me a while to get those out. But once they're done, I'm hoping they're going to be pretty in-depth and people will enjoy them. So that's Notes from the Edge.
And we're getting the secrets of Notes from the Edge, a little exclusive here on Postcards.
Pulling back the paper, as you would say. So that's Notes from the Edge. That's my discovery podcasting. I also do The Orb, as I mentioned earlier, with Matthew Rushing. That is our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast. So if you're a Niner, and for some reason you're a Trek FM listener who's never listened to The Orb, you definitely need to go do that. Matthew and I have had great conversations over the past 7 or 8 years now, I think it is, on The Orb about DS9. It's not an episode-by-episode kind of thing. We jump all over the place and go into really fine details about the series. And then there's The Ready Room, which I mentioned, which if you go deep into the catalog, which goes back 9 years, so this The Ready Room that CBS is doing on Facebook for Discovery, it's their franchise, it's their property. They can use the name, of course, that's their right. But I've been doing a show called The Ready Room for 9 years. And if you dig into the catalog, you can hear discussions on all the live action series. And we usually focus on an episode and their panel discussions with a mix of hosts from different shows.
I've been on one of them.
And you've been on, of course. I mean, most everyone, anyone who's been on the network more than 3 years has been on The Ready Room, because that used to be where new hosts came in and then branched off into other shows. And then the whole thing happened with my eye and I wasn't able to do the show the way I used to. But if you like hearing Larry Nemechek talk, Larry's a good friend of mine and we get together whenever we can, get on mic together and just talk about Star Trek. So most of The Ready Rooms over the past couple of years are just Larry and me. So you can check those out. And that's basically the extent of my podcasting these days. And The Orb and The Ready Room are both irregular. Hopefully, eventually, at least The Orb will get back under a regular schedule. And otherwise, you know, you can find my writing on the official website at StarTrek.com. And Twitter is my primary social media platform. So if you want to talk with me about Star Trek, go to Twitter. I do try to reply anytime someone asks me something, and I like having conversations on that platform. And my username there is C. Brian Jones, the letter C, and Brian with a Y. That's my username everywhere in social media. I'm also in the Babel Conference, although I don't post very often. I'm not really a Facebook user, but I do pop in there to see what's happening in the Babel Conference. And if you ask me something there, I do try to respond. So that's basically it, Amy. That's my Star Trek stuff anyway. And then my day-to-day life is I'm the editor-in-chief of two business magazines in Tokyo, and that keeps me very busy. But that content is probably not very interesting to most people listening to this show.
All right. Well, we would like to thank our associate producers of The Edge. They are Norman Lau, Tony Robinson, Thomas Puleo, Lisa Slack, Shoaib Mirza, Richard Rutledge, James Muldrow, Cornelia Reutner, Ryan Mallett, Chris Tribuzio, and Brian Melosh. Thank you for supporting Trek FM and especially The Edge.
Yeah, thank you so much. I just want to say, as the publisher of the network, huge thank you to everyone who supports us through Patreon. Most people don't know the cost of running this network. It's quite a lot. We go through massive bandwidth every month. So our hosting and our bandwidth alone is very expensive. And then we have the rest of the infrastructure as well. And this network would not exist, honestly, would not exist without the support of our patrons. So thank you very, very much for your support. And I hope that you'll continue supporting us. And if you're not already a patron, I hope that you'll consider doing so.
Well, Chris, it has been an honor to podcast with you. It's been a long time since we've been on mic together. So thank you so, so much.
Yeah, it has been, but it was great. Thanks for inviting me, Amy, and I'm glad that we could do a season two recap. This is actually the first time I've spoken on mic about Discovery season two, certainly since it finished. Maybe even in the middle, I don't think I talked about it. So thanks for the chance.
All right. Well, this wraps up Postcards for the Season. Until next time, hailing frequencies are now closed.